another edition of Warrior Connection. Boy, it's hard to believe, but tax day has come and gone, and we're recording this on tax day, the 15th, so hopefully everybody got it in. Sun bright here in Illinois. Again, having a nice day for a change. It's finally starting to warm up. Well, how about if we go back a few years, back when we were young puppies, and I headed over to Vietnam for the first time in March of 69. All this stuff came to me and the whole thing, and look back all the years. Well, today what we're going to do is take a trip back into Vietnam. We have a guest here that is now taking tours into Vietnam, and we want to have a good time with us and think about the past and look to the future more again. Patricia Axelrod, are you with us today?
I am indeed, and I am honored to present our guest for today. We have two guests on today, both of whom are writers and partners, and together they authored a book, their husband and wife, called Back to Vietnam, Tours of the Heart, written by R. Bruce Logan, our guest, and Elaine Head, his good wife. And the book, which reads very easily and is very engaging, received an award from the Military Writers Society of America. It received the Bronze Award, and it is dedicated to the brave warriors of Company A, 4th Battalion, 23 Infantry, Vietnam, 1966 to 67, and to the courageous people of Vietnam, the victims and survivors of the American War, their descendants and ancestors, whose resilience and forgiveness has inspired us. Now, Bruce served two tours in Vietnam from 66 to 67 and continued on and retired as a lieutenant colonel in 1989. He then moved to Canada, and he became a consultant in business as an expert in organizational development and corporate strategy. And Elaine, his good wife, is retired from a large Canadian food retailer, and she managed the Human Resources Department and then the Training Department of this company. And together, as I said, they have authored this book. And as an aside, we'll speak of this later, but Bruce has another book in the offing. And Bruce and Elaine, are you with us?
I'm here.
You are, Patricia.
Yeah, we're both here. Thank you.
Oh, thank you so
much.
Water
connection, guys.
Thanks very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
Well, Bruce, I know because I've read this book. I remember reading that when you left Vietnam, you said to yourself, and I guess to anyone else who could hear you, that I will never eat another piece of rice, never eat another morsel of rice, and I'll never return to Vietnam, never put my foot back in Vietnam again. So tell me, how is it that you've come full circle here? Tell us about this now, Bruce. And Elaine, I know that you are Bruce's partner in his travels and in these wonderful adventures. So please tell us about how this started, and tell us about Top, Tours of Peace.
Okay. You want me to start?
You start,
yes,
Bruce,
please.
And then
okay.
I'll chime in.
Okay. Yes, I did utter those things about 45 or 46 years ago. And but, you know, after I retired from the military in 1989, the Vietnamese government and the American government were sort of flirting once again about reestablishing relations, and the doors were starting to open to tourism. And I began to read stories and books and articles about other veterans who were going back to see what Vietnam is like now. I read about their coping with PTSD, and their really many of them were horrified at the prospect of going back, but they had the courage to go back. And they, quite frankly, were terrified about how they might be treated, you know, as the former big imperialistic, aggressive ogre soldier. I started getting interested in going back, so I read everything I could get my hands on about not only those going back, but about the present-day culture, sociology, geography, politics, and so on. And I found a website called Tours of Peace Vietnam Veterans. The acronym is TOP.
Also known as TOP, right?
Yeah, Top Vietnam Veterans. Found a website and noted on that website that this was an organization that specialized in conducting two-week tours for Vietnam veterans to take them back to the country and allow them to get a chance to see the country as it is now, and hopefully to replace the imagery that they may have been carrying around in their head for 30 or 40 years with Vietnam as it is now at peace. And so Elaine at first was not interested in going back with me, because she and I had not been married when I served my two tours there, and she was a Canadian, and, you know, it was never a Canadian war. It was our war. So she wasn't very interested until we found this website, and she noted on the website that a big component of what they do is try to promote healing for veterans that have got PTSD or maybe carry another baggage. And she thought, well, this maybe I should go along in case Bruce needs any support. So we went through the application process, and it's quite a lengthy process. We went through the process, we were accepted, and we went the first time in 2006. It was a two-week trip. Came back again, joined them again, and brought our daughter, daughter who was by that time well into her 30s, brought her back in 2000.
Eliza, right?
Yeah, Eliza is her name. We brought her back with us in 2007, and basically it was the same group again. But let me say a word about how TOP works, because the two tours were with TOP were very different. TOP takes a small number of people, maybe 10 or 12, to Vietnam each year, and they must be either veterans, or the spouse, or the offspring, or the widow of veterans. They have to go through an application process, and they organize the tour in such a way that they visit locations that were significant in some way to each of the participants. So that takes us back to battlefields, base camps, mountaintops, sites of helicopter crashes, those kind of things. And the other main component of the tours is they try to do humanitarian projects on almost a daily basis while the group is traveling. The group normally lands in Ho Chi Minh City and travels south to north, the whole length of what used to be South Vietnam. And during those travels, they'll stop at orphanages, leper villages, care homes for the aged, and deliver supplies and goods, and basically be ambassadors of goodwill and show a presence to these otherwise marginalized people. So Elena and I both, you know, I had never done anything like that before, and quite frankly didn't know how I'd feel getting my hands wet doing that kind of stuff. But Elena and I both thought it was fabulous. It felt good to be helping in that way. And so we, after our second tour with TOP, we decided we'd like to go back on our own and spend 3 months there doing volunteer work. And we've been doing that ever since. We've been going back every year for the last 8 years. And
actually, you've been there about 15 times. Is that right since then?
Well, I've been there about 15 times total, counting the trips with TOP and then the trips that Elaine and I have done on our own. And
right.
So she and I have been going back for 3 months at a time every year. In addition to that, I've also been going back with TOP for 2 weeks as the deputy tour director. So that brings us up to date.
Anyway, I know
Elaine?
that your heart really went out to the orphanages that you visited and the schools. Tell us about that, and tell us about, and please, both of you, Bruce and Elaine, tell us about some of the humanitarian work that you're doing over there. I understand that most of it is focused around Hoi An and the surrounding area, and I know that you've worked with a Buddhist orphanage which is feeding its children on about 35 cents a day. I know you're also instrumental in helping schools and helping to found schools. Tell us about this, please.
Well, I think I'll chime in here, Patricia. Our work has changed and evolved over the years, as you can imagine, as we've learned more about how to be effective in assisting the Vietnam people. We've moved from doling out money and goods to working with Vietnamese in organizations that are self-help and teaching skills and offering education so that the Vietnamese can create their own solutions. So one of the major things that we've been doing is working with a social enterprise in Hoi An who train and employ disabled persons to make crafts, and they run a craft shop to sell those crafts to tourists. And since we've been working with them, they have grown from perhaps 20 employees to almost 70 employees, and we're really proud of what they are doing. And they've opened a second business, which is a silent tea house run by the speech and hearing impaired. And that's a beautiful experience. We're also working with victims of Agent Orange. We used to, as I said, just provide funds. But now we have suggested to VAVA, which is a Vietnamese organization. It's actually a Red Cross subsidiary in Vietnam. And we've helped them develop the concept of microloans so that the loans are offered to people, and we've repaired fish boats. We've set a woman up in a knitting business. We've set people up in a thatch business so that they can begin to generate their own incomes. We also work with a woman who is intent on keeping girls in school. Poor girls are very vulnerable and are likely, most likely, the family members who don't go to school. Boys are favored, and if someone is too poor to pay the school fee...
it's about $50 a term, is that right?
It's more than that now, Patricia. It's accelerated so that it's more than $300 a year. So a family whose income is perhaps even $1,000 a year, which is quite common for rice farmers, they're unable to send all of their children to school, and so it's the girls who stay home and cook and look after their young siblings. So this Children's Education Foundation, with whom we work, pay the girls school fees so that they can stay in school. So we raise funds for that, and we also work with that organization from an organizational perspective and helping Linda, who is the on-ground person, in-country person, with organizing and planning. And one, two, three, four, I think that's it as far as the major projects are concerned. But then, as an aside, we're always buying bicycles so that kids could get to school. The orphanage that you mentioned, Patricia, is something that TOP does on a regular basis. It's called the Duxon Orphanage in Wei. And the nuns are doing a very good job, and they have, since we first went, gained some notoriety because the head nun is so well known now for the excellence of her operation. So as individuals, we step back from that one because they are raising the funds that they need.
What is the I'm thinking, when we come back in all the years and I look back at all the devastation, what is the cultural economic status in Vietnam today? I mean, virtually none of us have any knowledge of what has happened since we left there well over 40 years ago. What is the status, I mean, as far as jobs and the economy and housing and medical care?
I went to Vietnam this past December, and I was stunned by what I saw in the larger cities, in Ho Chi Minh City, which... as well as Hanoi, very bustling, very entrepreneurial, certainly free enterprise and capitalism were functioning as I saw it to be. But I imagine that you folks have a completely different and outlook on what's going on over there. I might add, I was rather surprised to see that there is a lot of home ownership, that people... do own their homes. They're building homes where the whole family lives there. And certainly there are lots of little motorcycles. So please now, yeah. Won't you enhance this view?
Well, economically, the country is on the go. And it had a very robust economy for about 10 years up until the global economy started to slow down in, shortly after the year 2000. But for about 10 years, it had a very robust economy growing at the rate of about 10 or 11% a year. That's slowed down a bit now, but you could still characterize it as Patricia said, it's a capitalist economy, it's a free market economy, even though it's a communist country. And so it is on the move, and there's 90 million people living there, and there's about 75 million motorbikes. So
it
is on the go. The
I still got my original motorbike from the 60s, so don't knock it, guys.
No, not knocking it at all. The cities are very progressive, a lot of hustle, bustle, everybody's on the go. You see, particularly in Ho Chi Minh City, you see a lot of very modern architecture, glitzy neon signs, upscale cafes, restaurants, bars, sidewalk cafes, and so forth. But you don't have to walk far in the cities also to find poverty and dirt and grime and garbage.
Mm-hmm.
And in the countryside, there are still a great many very rural poor people. Around, I think now the figure is around 70% of the population is agrarian. They live in rural areas. It was greater than that until a few years ago because the wealth being generated in the cities, as happens everywhere, started attracting the young people to the cities. And so there's been some migration to urban areas. But there's still some pockets in the countryside of real poverty. And many of them are just very, very poor rice farmers who struggle to make, like Elaine said, maybe on a good year they'll make $1,000 a year. But the most grinding poverty is in the ethnic minority areas, which are basically the hills and the central highlands and the formal north of Vietnam. And there's 53 minority tribes. And many of them are characterized just by abject poverty. They are on subsistence living. If their kids go to school at all, they usually go in a one-room hovel, which is breezy, leaky, has a dirt floor. So we do see that. They're, you know, economically they're on the move, but there's also a great deal of poverty there. There's an emerging middle class, but the poor are remaining very poor.
Mm-hmm. That's what I took note of as well. In the city, even in the cities, this is apparent as you look down the alleys that there is grinding poverty there.
Exactly.
And that there is a growing class of the haves with the have-nots, unfortunately, in the same position as they have been for generations. And I also took note that the water buffalo is still very much in use there, that the farming techniques were the same as have been always in use there. There's no modern farm machinery that I took note of.
Well, we do see the occasional mechanized farm, but you're right. About 80% of the rice paddies are still tilled with a farmer following a water buffalo around the field. But nowadays, it's not uncommon to see that farmer, as he's plowing behind his water buffalo, speaking on a cell phone.
Yes, I know. That's very interesting. That's correct. Yeah, that's very true. Now, you mentioned that you work with the victims of Agent Orange, mm-hmm. and I think that Americans are largely misinformed about the effects and impacts of Agent Orange on the Vietnamese. Many Americans believe that the United States has paid a certain sum of money to the Vietnamese people for purposes of treating those who have been made ill. That was not my observation, but can you tell us what you see?
Yeah. The legacy of Agent Orange is still a lingering, serious, very visible problem in Vietnam. And the veterans and their families who are directly exposed to it oftentimes suffer the same maladies that American veterans do. And you know, we know there's a list of about 22 or 3 different things that the VA now recognizes as having a cause and effect relationship with Agent Orange. So many of the former soldiers, both South Vietnamese and Viet Cong and NVA and their families, suffer those kind of problems. But the biggest problem in Vietnam with respect to Agent Orange is second and third generation people to whom the problem has been, they've had a disability passed genetically. And that's characterized by birth defects. One of the most horrid ones to see is, I may not pronounce this right, macrocephalism, you know, where there's water on the brain and the head becomes very enlarged.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a number of other birth defects. Some resemble cerebral palsy. Some are characterized by extra digits, extra fingers, extra toes. Some are characterized by missing fingers, missing toes, and so
missing
on.
Missing limbs, yes. Uh-huh.
Yeah. Now, the problem is there's no demonstrative way to definitely establish a cause and effect relationship with many of these second and third generation birth defects with Agent Orange. However, I think it's more than a coincidence that Vietnam has a very disproportionate number of these birth defects compared to the countries surrounding it, Cambodia, Malaysia, Laos, and so on. It's also noteworthy that these birth defects have a much higher incident rate in the areas that were hotspots for Agent Orange. That includes three locations where it was stored, Da Nang, Saigon, and I think the other was Phan Thiet. And also the spots that were excessively sprayed. As far as compensation, the United States government has not compensated individual victims of Agent Orange in Vietnam. Although the U.S. government's position has softened after being in denial many, many years, it's softened with respect to the effects of Agent Orange. It still hasn't gone to the point of compensating victims for the simple reason that cause and effect cannot be proved. Now, what the U.S. has done is ponied up some money to help with the cleanup of a couple of the hot spots. So what they're doing is they're removing the ground contamination that's been there for 4 or 5 decades around former Da Nang Air Base and Tan Sanut Air Base in Saigon. So there is money going in. The United States government is sort of acknowledging the problem, but they haven't gone as far as to compensate the people that are affected by it.
One of the questions I have, too, is since it's been so many years, as you go back, what proportion of the population, or like all of us who went to Vietnam, we're now in our 60s and beyond,
mm-hmm.
What proportion of the population is still there that was involved in the military activities, and what kind of response do you see from them if you do encounter them?
Good questions, both good questions. The number of people that were involved is very small. Vietnam is a country of 90 million people, and it's something like 75% of them are under 40.
So it's a very young country, right?
It's a very young country. But we do encounter veterans from all sides, NVA, VC, North Vietnamese, Viet Cong, and South Vietnamese soldiers. We encounter them, and we encounter families that have been impacted brutally by the war, you know, caught in artillery barrages, caught in airstrikes, so on and so forth. We encounter all of these people. Much to my surprise, and they know who I am and who the other veterans that I take back and go there with, they know who we are. And much to my surprise, we're treated very, very welcomely and very, very openly by all of these people, to include the former enemy. And my take on that is they've just moved well beyond the war, which may characterize, maybe a reflection of the Buddhist notion that, you know, you live life for the moment and you just keep you move forward and don't worry so much about the past. But we've heard remarks like, well, you know, that was a long time ago. We can all be brothers now. And whenever I encounter a former enemy soldier, I invariably get slapped on the back or hugged, and at the very least I get a really warm handshake and a big smile. So it's not a problem for veterans to go back.
I think what we see that's very surprising, however, is that the vets of the South Vietnamese Army are not compensated in any way. They continue to be treated very badly. They have separate grave sites. They are not on any pension at all. Their descendants are not allowed to hold government jobs. So there still is some real discrimination towards the Southern Vietnamese Army.
Elaine and Bruce, for the benefit of the young people listening to this program, some of whom may not be familiar with the particularities of North and South Vietnam, perhaps you would very briefly, or Doug, if you care to, or I can, we can just very briefly jump in here and discuss the Vietnam War and Ho Chi Minh and the North, the differences between North and South, and why the soldiers of the South Vietnamese Army would be treated differently?
Well, to put it in the simplest terms, for 20 years, between 1954 and 1975, Vietnam was two countries, North and South. And North Vietnam was a communist country led by Ho Chi Minh, and they aligned themselves very much with Red China and later on Russia. South Vietnam was supposedly a democratic republic, aligned very much with the United States and with the Western camp. When the two countries were separated at the end of the French colonial period, when they became two countries, there was a provision that they would have elections within a couple of years to reunify and become one country again. Those elections never occurred. North Vietnam wanted the reunification. Probably many of the persons who lived in the South did as well, but it didn't happen. So the North commenced some guerrilla operations against the South Vietnamese government, and that grew and grew and grew and grew until it became a full-scale insurgency in South Vietnam, with being fought both by local Southerners who became instruments of the North, and they were known as the Viet Cong, and then also the North Vietnamese soldiers that came south to fight. They were the NVA, or the North Vietnamese soldiers. And as most people know, America jumped in on the side of the South Vietnamese government, and very early on, we sent advisors starting in 1954-55.
Excuse me, Bruce?
Yes.
For perhaps the younger listeners, maybe you could just quickly let them know why the U.S. did jump in on the side of the South, and that because of their fear of encroaching communism.
Yeah, well,
during that time of history, the Western world was very...
Sure. The party line was that, you know, these were during the day, this was during the height of the Cold War, when the United States really feared the global expansion of communism. And because North Vietnamese aligned itself with the communist camp and began this infiltration into the South, it was perceived by the West to be largely a ideological war, a war about communism. And the danger perceived was that if the South should fall and become a communist country, then Malaysia would fall, then Cambodia would fall, then Thailand would fall. Sooner or later, Australia and New Zealand would fall, and communism would spread its way across the Pacific. And this was known
and
as the domino
effect.
Right. This was known as the domino theory. So that's the story for public consumption on the part of the United States government as to why we got involved. It's probably much deeper than that, and I don't know if we need to get into that, but there were other political and economic considerations as well.
Well, I think the other part, obviously, was all of the oil that BP ended up getting and just recently sold back to American Oil Firm, and then we had all the food in the South and in the Mekong Delta, all the food production.
Yeah, that's it.
And we also had titanium, which was interesting, in Vietnam, which was interesting to people. But with all of that said, before we go into, and I'm sure we can all of us discuss this beyond the pale, perhaps it's important to just interject as Bruce lays this out and as we discuss this, any listener who is hearing about this so-called domino effect and the war of Vietnam, it's important to point this out. The relevance of this war is its similarity to the wars that we're fighting now in the Middle East. Bruce has described a difference between the North and the South and the philosophical differences and how this led into a war, ultimately, which the United States did not win. We had to retreat from. So I would take the liberty right now of pointing out to our listeners the significance of this war, the significance of what Bruce and Elaine are saying right now about these trips back to Vietnam and how curative they are for the veterans who are suffering from PTSD and how this is helping to heal them. Because the time will come when veterans who have fought fought in this Iraq war and other wars that are being fought right now will look to top the tours of peace and will look to Bruce as models of how they can be helped. So forgive me for interjecting that, but I thought it would be timely to do so.
No, that's okay.
One of the things, Bruce, here, how do you find the effects? I mean, so many years ago and everything we were involved in, as you yourself and the others you've been with go over there, what happens to the individual veteran that's going back? What changes take place or insights or what is happening to the individual when they go back on something like this?
Give us kind of a typical tour, if you could, Bruce.
Okay, yeah, I can speak from my...
Or a typical individual. That story is probably the best way to describe it, Bruce.
Are you talking about Chuck?
I know that each tour is very highly individualized is because it would depend upon what experience that veteran has had, and it is that, or those veterans have had, and it is that which shapes the trip. So please go on.
Yes. Well, we can speak from our experience with TOP, and I can speak from my own experience. I've also taken a number of veterans who are in the infantry unit I served in Vietnam in 66 and 67 back. So it was sort of like an intact group going back after 40 years. I can speak to those experiences, but I want to be careful to affirm that I don't know that you can generalize these experiences to every Vietnam veteran that goes back, because I have read accounts in a few other places about some veterans, particularly in the early days of veterans going back when we were all younger, some veterans going back with the notion that they were going to relive their fantasies and relive some of their useful escapades while they're in Vietnam the first time. But in our experience, it's been a very positive experience for the veterans we've seen go back. And the case that Elaine wanted us to tell you about is a former Marine who suffered horrible PTSD after his tour in Vietnam. He spent 30 days fighting on a hilltop outside the Khe Sanh combat base. Any older veterans will remember the Battle of Khe Sanh. 30 days on a hilltop with his Marine company, surrounded by thousands and thousands of North Vietnamese Army. They were mortared every night. They were rocketed during the day. They were had probes on their perimeter constantly. He was wounded a couple of times, usually flown out in a helicopter, patched up, and sent back in. Anyway, he went home with very serious PTSD, became heavily into alcohol and all those other dysfunctional behaviors that go with PTSD. And then finally he began to emerge from his PTSD. He went to college. He began to emerge from his PTSD when he met a young woman that was keen on helping him. And so they ultimately got married. He put most of the problem behind him, got a job as a bank, rose to become a vice president of the bank, and then Desert Storm started in 1990, as you recall. And through CNN's technology, that war was brought right into everybody's living room on a 24-hour-a-day basis. And his PTSD reoccurred severely. And he was back on the bottle, having very serious troubles, lost his job at the bank, almost lost his wife and his children. But through counseling and so forth, he began to pull himself up again after a couple of years. He had to take a menial job as a custodian in a high school. His daughter was a young adult, persuaded him to go back with a tour of peace. And she said, and she had been on one herself a year earlier, had gone on TOP just as a dependent daughter of a veteran to see what it was all about. So she persuaded her dad to go back and her mom to go with her dad for support. So the three of them were on the first TOP tour that Elaine and I were on. And after about 13 days in the country of looking at other people's significant sites, we climbed our way to the hilltop where he had served and fought. And it was a hot day. We shouldn't have attempted to start this at 11 o'clock because none of us had the vigor that we'd had 40 years earlier. But we managed to climb this 881-meter hill. We didn't start at from sea level, but of course, but we climbed this hill, got to the top, had to watch for unexploded ordnance the whole way up. We had to have three guides along with us, one of them who was the a scrap metal hunter and could point out the unexploded ordnance. So we were stepping around old artillery rounds and so forth. Got to the top of the hill, and this old veteran found this old Marine veteran found what had been his foxhole. You know, now just a shallow depression in the ground, but he found his foxhole. And then he started walking the perimeter and was able to identify all of these other former fighting positions, and was remembering the men, remembering the events, remembered the incidents. He had tears streaming down his eyes, streaming down his cheeks as he wandered around this hilltop. But he appreciated the peaceful verdancy of the countryside surrounding the hilltop all around. The hills were green again, even though they'd been defoliated at one time. The hills were green. There was a meandering river making a serpentine, cutting a serpentine path through one of the river valleys. And it was just a very idyllic scene. And then he came off that hilltop feeling much better about everything. And he felt much better about everything, having done the humanitarian jobs that we'd been doing for a couple of weeks. So that he really was able, as I said earlier, he was able to replace the imagery that he'd been carrying in his head for 40 years with new imagery about what Vietnam was like now and what the people are like and so forth. So that was a success story, and that was very typical.
But you always forget the last chapter, darling.
I'm coming to the sequel.
Oh, good.
That was very typical of what we see with both top veterans and the other veterans that I've taken back. The sequel to the story about this Marine is, when he got home, several days later, he went back to work in the high school, and he was summoned, in the middle of the day, he was summoned backstage in the auditorium to repair a piece of audiovisual equipment. And he was back there tinkering with the audiovisual equipment, and all of a sudden the curtains are drawn, and there sat the whole student body of the high school. This makes me emotional, with the band playing the Marine Corps hymn. And so, you know, that was his welcome home that he didn't get 40 years earlier.
Oh, yes, of course. That was his acknowledgement.
Exactly.
Yeah, instead of being spit on and told to think less of himself, this was his welcome home.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I see when I go back to the day, and I came back from Vietnam after my second tour and had my last combat mission less than 24 hours before I landed back at O'Hare here in Chicago. But then in 1991, I came back from Desert Storm almost to the day into the hour when I came back from Vietnam the second time. I think the differences between all of us when we went over to Vietnam as individual replacements and then came back as individuals, and then Desert Storm, how that changed and what it is today. I mean, it is just, the impact is so different.
Well, you've nailed it precisely. You've nailed it exactly. The one-year tour of going as individuals and coming back as individuals was very dysfunctional to morale, welfare, and I think it probably facilitated PTSD. Because,
well, I know when I went over my first ArcLight, it was 6 months, and we came back, and then we went over, and it was supposed to be a one-year, and then it ended up being 18 months because on B-52s, what I was doing, they didn't have enough air crew or enough maintenance support staff to, you know, let us rotate in and out. And it's kind of like once you're there, you're there.
Yeah.
And it was so strange to come back out because, I mean, what literally when I came back and I got out and then I started college just a few days later, and it was like we weren't even a human being, but then we went on to thrive and to succeed and everything else, just like it's unlike you did.
Yeah. Yeah, it's interesting because the Vietnam veterans' fathers who fought in World War II came home when the war ended, but they came home as a unit. They didn't come home as individuals. They came home as a unit, and many of them came home on ships. So they had 30 or 40 days to sort of chill out, and they had the therapy of their companionship when they left combat. In Vietnam, you know, the soldier came home alone, and as you said, landed at Travis Air Force Base, California, and 8 hours later he might be at a church dinner with his family, and they treat him like he's been hitchhiking through Europe.
Yeah, it was so strange because and the other thing too, and this goes back to the going back and forth everything. When we landed at Travis that day, this was in June, and that first week of June in 1971, it was very clear. Get out of your military uniform. And that was the first time I ever saw a girl in hot pants. Holy cow. that had showed up while I was overseas.
Sadly, though, this hasn't changed. The returning veteran from Iraq or whatever, it comes back alone, cannot speak of this at all, and takes this experience, this horror and this pain, and tucks it away, compartmentalizes it, and attempts to go back into life and into work. Doesn't necessarily talk to their mother or their father. So the experience is being repeated, which means, unfortunately, we haven't learned anything from Vietnam.
How does an individual, say, for example, anybody that's listening here, how, if they want to take a tour or go over to Vietnam and visit, how do you go about it? What's involved in going back over? I mean, you say there's long application process and everything. Could you kind of describe what's involved from from when you make a decision, hey, I want to go, to it actually happening?
Yeah, if anybody is interested in going back with TOP, Tours of Peace Vietnam Veterans, they should explore the website, which is www.topvietnamveterans.org. And TOP Vietnam Veterans, all one word. They should explore the website, and then there's a Contact Us button where they can hit that button and they can get their questions answered about going back with TOP. But just by going to the website, they'll get a really good idea about what the tours are like, what the objective of the tours are, and what they might expect when they get into Vietnam.
And we should add, too, that TOP is not the only organization does this. There are several others, if people are exploring on the web, that there are several organizations that do the same thing. Some are Christian-based, some are medical health-based. Like, there's a group of physiotherapists that go back that are all veterans, but there are several.
Can you give us the title of the book and how people can obtain a copy of your book and everything on that, please?
Sure. The book is entitled Back
to Bruce.
Vietnam, Tours of the Heart. It's only available in a very small number of independent bookstores, but it is available as an e-book, as a Kindle, from Amazon.com. And if persons are interested in a hard copy of the book, they could obtain that by going to our website, which is www.backtovietnam.com, or they could even call us at 250-537-4127, and we'd be more than pleased to fire one off to them.
Let me, if I might, take the liberty of qualifying the TOP trip, and I know you told me this, Bruce, so I'll just hop in here and say that TOP is screens their candidates very thoroughly, and they want to ensure that the veterans who are traveling with them are physically capable of the rigorous physicality that's required to make these trips. And further, I vetted some of the other groups that go back. Not every group is engaged in humanitarian work, which I think is perhaps some of the most healing part of the trip. So veterans that are looking at this and hearing us, or families of veterans, might want to ensure that tour is involving the humanitarian work that you folks have undertaken and that you have found to be so very healing. Am I right?
Oh, absolutely.
Well,
yeah.
I think as you were speaking, Patricia, the thought occurred to me that we felt that was a critical element in our healing and our understanding of the country. But the reality is that some veterans don't need that or don't want that or not interested.
I know that. Yes, I understand
and
that.
And the groups that Bruce has taken separate from TOP, that's not a piece of it that captures their interest at all. So it's an individual choice, I think. It certainly for us was most significant because the humanitarian work changed our lives, Bruce's for the second time in Vietnam and mine for the first. That's what grabbed our hearts. that's what helped us realize that there was a world beyond our cosseted North American upbringing. But it's not for everybody. So I think it's a significant piece for a lot of people, but there are groups that go over without that. And
Comes into play here is, I mean, it wasn't just Vietnam or North or South Vietnam, and we were involved in Cambodia and Laos and Thailand.
Yes.
So we've got all of these nations that were totally engulfed in this mess. I know I was in and out of Thailand all the time. And then mm-hmm. we were also, you know, over to Guam and then Okinawa and then Taiwan, CCK. So it was just the whole region was involved in this whole mess.
Yeah, and the legacy lives on not only in South Vietnam, not only in Vietnam, but in also in Cambodia and Laos, in the form of unexploded ordnance, you know, as well as Agent Orange. That's a huge problem. It remains a huge problem.
And perhaps this would be a good segue, not to mitigate anything that we're saying here, but this might be a very good segue for you to talk about your next book coming up. I know you've been to Cambodia to research this, and this has to do with child sexual slavery. So perhaps you could briefly mention this, too. We have a few minutes left, so please tell us about this work that you're doing there and the book that you both have coming out.
Okay. One of the social problems we've become really familiar with by traveling back to Vietnam, Elaine and I, is this whole business of child trafficking, which, of course, is a global problem, but it seems to be have a real epicenter in Southeast Asia. And as Elaine said a little bit earlier, unfortunately, a lot of poor girls are vulnerable to trafficking, and they get sold into sexual slavery, oftentimes by a relative because the family needs money so badly, and sometimes they're duped into it by being told they're going to Ho Chi Minh City or Da Nang or some major city where they'll have a good job and they can send money home to help the family. And then when they get to these places, they find themselves smuggled into Cambodia or into China, some cases into Thailand, some cases into Malaysia, where they end up being in a brothel. And they may be as young as 10 or 11 years old. So it's a serious problem. And when we became aware of it, I did a lot of research about child trafficking and tried to get familiar with the literature on child trafficking. And I know there's a great deal written in the academic and journalistic literature about child trafficking. And I thought, well, I'd like to add my voice here, but there's no sense writing a journalistic expose because that's been done countless times and it probably all gets read by the same audience. And I thought, well, if I try my hand at fiction, maybe we could reach a bigger audience. So that's what I've been involved in the last 2 years. I've been trying to write a book that focuses on one particular young girl who is the victim of trafficking and gets smuggled into Cambodia and ends up working in a brothel in a little village in Cambodia called Svai Pak, which happens to be a real village that has been infamous for years and years and years as a center of child sexual slavery. And so that's what I've been working on. The manuscript is finished. I mean, we're in the revision and editing stage now, so hopefully we might see something happen with it late this year.
Does it have a tentative title, a working title?
Yes, it has a working title. The working title is Broken Coconuts.
Uh-huh. What is that? I'm sure that's a metaphor for something. What does that mean?
It is. It's symbolic. girls who are forced into sexual slavery and therefore lose their innocence in Cambodia are referred to in a Khmer slang term as broken girls or broken coconuts.
I see. So that coconut is a metaphor for the child's virginity.
Yes, exactly.
I see. Yeah. Well, I'm sure that will be well received. Have you a publisher in mind yet, Bruce?
No, I'm still exploring that right now. I'm working with an editor and a mentor that is giving me some leads there, but it's still a wide open exploration. And if I can't find a publisher, I may end up self-publishing it, and then the challenge will be getting it distributed and promoted. But we may go that route. We'll see.
Well, I only got about 3 or 4 minutes left here, Bruce and Elaine. Kind of like open the door here for you to make any suggestions, observations, recommendations. Say anything that you want to say to close out our show here.
Okay, Elaine?
No, go, Bruce. I'll have to think.
Okay. No, I would just say to any Vietnam veteran who's been thinking about going back and has been hesitant for one reason or another, if you're healthy, by all means, do it. It'll change your life. You'll find Vietnam so welcoming and friendly. It will, as I've said, it will obviate a lot of the imagery you've been carrying around. And it'll change your life. And you don't necessarily
have... What is the path of getting from here to there? How do folks get from... Where do they take off from? Where do they land? Or where do they go in?
Yes, you go in. You can go either into Hanoi or Ho Chi Minh City. And the typical hubs that you might... If you leave the west coast of the United States, you would probably... Depending on what airline you fly, you would probably stop in Hong Kong or Taipei. In some cases, Manila. And then into Ho Chi Minh City or Hanoi.
And I guess my last words would be, as the spouse of a veteran returning, it would be to encourage wives to go with their husbands, because the experience provides a depth of understanding that one doesn't have living in your home. And just seeing your man on the ground and watching, the description of where they were and where the enemy was behind the trees in the jungle, it just becomes very real. And it really strengthens the partnership and strengthens the understanding. So I would encourage wives to go, too.
Well, I'm glad you guys came on. This has been totally incredible. I guess, one thing we go back and we think about this, that was over 40 years for a lot of us. It really has shaped our life, and it can still shape our destiny, can't it?
Absolutely. No question about it.
Mm-hmm.
Like Elaine said a little bit earlier, I say Vietnam changed my life two times, once in 1966 and again after the turn of the century.
And the other thought that I have used in the book is we were all thinking of the people that we had been, but also the people that we could become. And I think that's the strength of the story, that we are still growing.
And I guess this is best illustrated by the fact that you now have a family in Vietnam who has adopted you, and it has even gone so far as to say that when you pass, they'd love to have the honor of cremating you. Is that not right?
Yeah.
Yes, they do.
Yeah. So that's a great way of illustrating a full circle, that you now have a family there in Vietnam, and you live over there about 3 months of the year. Is that right?
That's correct,
right.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm.
Right. And your Chinese proverb that you quote is certainly correct, and is demonstrated by this interview and by your book, and it says, he or she who returns from a journey is not the same as he who left. So you are certainly a different person. I imagine with each trip you come back a little bit changed, a little bit different.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say, yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
It's a wonderful thing in one's 70s to feel that and to know that your world is getting broader rather than smaller. It's so gratifying for us to have this work, in our latter years.
Right. This has liberated you, hasn't it?
I think so.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. I imagine it will liberate anyone who goes over there who is suffering the prison. And PTSD is a prison. Who is suffering in the prison of PTSD. This
mm-hmm.
would be freeing and liberating.
Mm-hmm.
You're an old veteran now. Tell us what you have to say.
I'm sorry?
Doug?
Well, yeah, I keep thinking about this because I've been involved in so much. I mean, going to Vietnam, a Desert Storm, involved in Operation Iraqi Freedom, Enduring Freedom, and still fighting for it. I mean, this morning I had another veteran that needed help, and we were off trying to help him. And, again, it's never going to end. I think the organizations and the government sure haven't taken care of the vets. So as like we've said on this radio show over and over again, it's up to the vets to take care of the vets. And I don't think that's going to change. I think that's gone back to antiquity, and it's going to continue, because even when we break down between the countries we were involved in bombing or destroying, there's got to be a future, and how do we get there? It's up to us.
And you know what? What you've just said about vets take care of vets, that's an extension of what combat is like. You know, the soldier who's in combat is not fighting for any ideology. He's not fighting for his country. He's not fighting for his president. They're fighting for each other.
And we were all young puppies when we first did that.
Yep, exactly.
I think the strangest thing, I had a letter when I first got over there, and my grandma said, well, what are you doing, and what's this involved? And I'm going, wait, Grandma, how do I know? I'm only 19 years old.
The irony of it is that, of course, you all thought you did know when you were over there, and now you recognize you didn't know, and you don't know, and you're still learning, right?
Exactly, yeah.
That's exactly right, yeah. As long as we have a little bit of time here, and it seems like we have a little more time than we thought we had, I'd like to speak about the documentary that you helped make over there very briefly. I understand that you were asked to participate in a documentary in Vietnam, and this perhaps is a good way also to end this, because It's the question that was asked of you was, they wanted you to answer for the benefit of this documentary was, why did the U.S., if the U.S. won on the battlefield, why didn't you win the war? And maybe I could read this, Bruce, but maybe you'll just recap that question for the benefit of those who are listening, because it's an important lesson that you have learned, that so many veterans have learned, but our country has not yet learned.
Yeah, well, my response was that, we didn't lose on the battlefield. We won every major engagement that we were involved in. And, you know, we had overwhelming firepower and maneuverability and so forth. And we didn't lose a single solitary major engagement. And I think we won the war militarily. But we left Vietnam for social and political reasons. We left Vietnam, quite frankly, because America had lost, didn't have the stomach for the war. And the irony of that is not many Vietnamese had any stomach for the war either. But we left for political reasons, and it was a settlement negotiated, of course, in Paris by Dr. Henry Kissinger and his counterpart from North Vietnam. I think we made a number of mistakes in the first place by being there. Even though we won militarily, we made a number of very serious mistakes, not least of which was failing to really understand the culture and failing to understand that 95% of the Vietnamese people were peasants who didn't care a whit about government or ideology or politics. Their whole reference system was home, rice paddy, ancestors, and family. No side ever had their support. Probably the guerrillas had more peasant support than any of the conventional sides, because many of the guerrillas lived in the villages from which the peasants came. So that was a big part of it. And we also failed to understand that the Vietnamese people had put up with 2,000 years worth of invasions and conflict and war.
Well, that's right. Our time is up. Bruce, Elaine, Patricia, thank you very much. God bless you. And Bruce, let's keep in touch and let us know when your new book comes out, please.
Thanks very much. It was an honor to be with you today.
God bless you. Thank you very much. God bless America. Take care. Remember, take care of the vets, ladies and gentlemen. Good night.